The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
My name is Lou Marcos, and I'm from Houston, Texas. And I just flew over here from Houston yesterday with my son Alex. And as I was flying from Houston here, I was reminded of a story of a New York businessman who had to fly down to Houston for a business conference. Now, this man was a newlywed. He'd only been married for 6 months, and this was the first time he was separated from his wife. And he loved her dearly. And so the moment he got to his Houston hotel room, he pulled out his little smartphone and sent her an email. Unfortunately, in his haste, he typed in the wrong email address. And so instead of the email going to his wife in New York City, it went to an 85-year-old woman in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, this woman had been married for 60 years, and just the night before, her husband had passed away in his sleep. But she was doing well. She had a lot of support in her community. But that night, that woman disappeared. Nobody could find her. They searched up and down. Finally, they said, wait a minute. This was a modern woman who knew how to use her computer. Let's go look in the study. Maybe she's there. And sure enough, they opened the door to the study, and they found the poor woman passed out in front of her computer. And nobody could understand why until they thought to look at the screen. And this is what they read. To my dearest wife, I have arrived safely. I am awaiting your arrival next week. P.S. I suggest you wear shorts because it's awfully hot down here. So watch out when you send those emails. Now, today and tomorrow, I am going to be taking you to hell two times over. Now, my two speeches, they stand on their own, but if you come tomorrow, today's about Dante. Tomorrow, an hour earlier, I'm going to be speaking about C.S. Lewis and the Great Divorce. But my focus is going to be hell and the nature of sin. One of our themes this week is virtue and vice. So I want to talk a little bit about the nature of sin and vice. First, what Dante can teach us, and then what C.S. Lewis, who was a real mentee of Dante, what he can teach us. Most of you know that the Divine Comedy, the Inferno, begins with Dante, who says, in the middle of my years, I woke to find myself lost in a dark wood. How I got there, I don't know, but he's terrified and he wants to get out. And as he begins to walk, he sees a little hill rising up and the sun is shining on the top of the hill. And he thinks, oh, I can get out of this terrible, scary wood. And so he starts to ascend the hill. But as he begins, his progress is stopped by three ferocious beasts, a leopard, a lion, and a she-wolf. And those three animals prevent him from getting up to the sun, and he goes back into the darkness in despair until Virgil appears. Now, most of you know that the Divine Comedy is in part an allegory. And in the Middle Ages, and even back to Plato, the sun is usually a representation of God's love, God's grace, God's goodness. Well, if the sun shining on the top of the hill represents God and salvation and grace, what stops us from getting to God? What do the beasts represent? Can you guess? They represent sin. Sin is what cuts us off from communion with God. And later on, you'll see that those three animals represent the three basic categories of sin. Now, what I'm going to do is, much time as I have, I'm going to take you on a whirlwind tour through Dante's Inferno, level by level. I'm going to move quickly, and I'm going to be focusing specifically on what Dante teaches us about the nature of sin. So as we move quickly, I'm going to point out some things that I think Dante can teach us still today, particularly as educators in a classical Christian school, that care about instilling virtue in our students. Now, Dante and Virgil pass through the gateway to hell. That's the one that says, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. A lot of the boys' dorms where I teach, I think, have that sign over, or they should. So they go into hell, and the first place they come to is not the first level of hell. The first place they come to is called the vestibule. It's the hallway. It's not really in hell or in heaven. It's somewhere in between. And there in the vestibule are punished what are sometimes called the neutrals or sometimes called the opportunists. These were people that refused to take sides in life. And they are not wanted by heaven. They're not even wanted by hell. They're stuck in the vestibule, and it's all sort of smoky and misty. And all of the opportunists are running endlessly in a circle, chasing after a banner, a flag. And of course, on earth, they never would swear allegiance to any flag or banner. And so no matter how fast they run, they can never catch it. Now, as they run, these gnats are biting them endlessly, causing pimples to come up. They burst, and all of the stuff comes down, runs down to their feet, where it's devoured by maggots. Isn't that lovely? Aren't you glad you're not quite ready for dinner? Definitely not now, okay? It's meant to be nasty because these people are sort of moral refuse. They're the garbage that neither heaven nor hell want. Now, any of you that have studied a little bit about the biography of Dante, you'll know that Dante was exiled from Florence. And in fact, he wrote the Divine Comedy in exile from his beloved city and never returned. He died in exile. Dante fell foul of sort of what we would call partisan politics. He took one side, he took another. When he took the side, they won. But then the other side came in and threw him out. Now, if you think about that, given the fact that Dante's life was destroyed by parties fighting, you might think that Dante would think that a world of all opportunists would be a good world. But absolutely not. For Dante, we must take sides. That doesn't necessarily mean we have to be, quote, political. But we have to take sides in life. We can't be. Do you know amongst the opportunists are not only humans, but angels? The angels that refused to take the side of Satan or God, who said, we're going to sit in the sideline and wait till we find out who wins, and then we'll say, we were with you guys all the time. No, they are cast out. The first thing, we need to be involved in history. The God we serve is not a deistic God. The God we serve is intimately involved in human history, and we need to be involved in that human history as well, or we will be left on the outside. If you think of the Bible is made up of 66 books written over a long period by all different authors. What gives the Bible its unity? Now, the obvious answer is Jesus. That's always the right answer at our schools. But there's another answer. What gives the Bible its unity? This is how I define the Bible. The Bible is a record or a chronicle of all of God's actions and interactions in human history. Let me say that again. The Bible is a record or chronicle of all of God's actions and interactions in history. God creates the world. He enters the world. He sends the Ten Commandments. He himself becomes a man incarnate in Christ. God is intimately involved, and we need to be intimately involved. Everybody being an opportunist does not make the world God wants. Do you know what the world would be like if everybody was an opportunist? You all remember the song Imagine? Very beautiful song, but I like to call Imagine the John Lennon version of peace. You know what the John Lennon version of peace is? If we're all high on drugs, we can't fight wars. And to a certain extent, that's true, right? If we all just didn't care, if we all just played with our cell phones or, you know, smartphones 24 hours a day and never interacted, there probably would be less wars. But there also would not be the world God created, the world of action and interaction. So the first thing, ultimately, is sin. It is sinful to just completely pull yourself out, right? Now, there are exceptions, right? God might call you to be a monk living in a monastery all alone. I'm not talking about you all have to be political. But we need to be involved. God is involved, and we need to be involved. And not to be involved is to be cast out into the darkness, into the vestibule. Now, Once they pass the vestibule, they're ready to go into hell proper. But to get to hell proper, you have to cross the first river of hell. The first river is the river Acheron. The second one you hear is the river Styx. There's the river Phlegeton, and there's a river Cocytus. And we'll talk about all four of those quickly. But as they go through, they come to the first river, and that's where Charon, you know, the ferryman of the dead, ferries them over the river into hell proper. Now, later in the Inferno, Dante asks a question of Virgil. Where does all these rivers come from? What is the source of the rivers of hell? And even though almost everything in the Inferno imitates something else, it's meant to, you know, look back to Homer and Virgil, here's something that, as far as I can tell, Dante made up. I can't find this anywhere else in, you know, Homer or Virgil or Plato or Cicero. I think he made this up. What is the source of the rivers of hell? Dante tells us, or Virgil tells Dante, that in Crete, now Crete is kind of like Sicily. It's like in between Africa, Asia, and Europe. It's sort of a crossroads of the world. And there on Crete is a giant statue, Virgil says, with a head made of gold, a chest of silver, bronze, all the way down to iron. Now, where does that image come from? Somebody shout it out. The book of Daniel, right? And if you remember, that giant represents the kingdoms of the world. It represents humanity, the kingdoms of man. Now here's what Dante adds. The statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream is actually crying and weeping, and the tears run down, rip open all the metals, fall down into the earth, and they become the rivers of hell. So understand, the rivers of hell are made of the tears of humanity. Because hell is a sad, sad place. Hell is a place of waste, of wasted dreams, of wasted opportunities, of people who gave up the light that was given them. A little farther in hell, we meet the slothful, the couch potato people, people guilty of sullenness or sloth. And they're fixed in slime. And over they keep saying, "Sullen were we in the air made sweet by the sun. Beneath it shining, our hearts poured a bitter smoke. Sullen were we begun, sullen we lie forever in this ditch." And they say it over and over again without pause. I really hope that you will teach your students at your schools from an early age right up to high school one of the most important parables in the Bible for students, and it was very important for Dante, is called the Parable of the Talents. It's in Matthew 25, and most of you know the story. A master is going away on a long journey. By the way, that's the problem. If the darn master would just stay home, there would be no problem, okay? But he keeps leaving, okay? But anyway, he goes away, and he calls his three chief stewards to him. And to one he gives 5 talents, to another he gives 2, and to the third he gives 1. Now you probably know that back then a talent was a unit of money. But because of that parable, we now get our word talent, because Jesus is using the money as a metaphor for our, you know, our God-given gifts and talents. And again, because of that, that's where we get our word talent. That's actually the etymology of the word talent. Now, he gives them each, and then he goes away on a long journey. He comes back after a long time, unannounced, and he calls them to give an accounting. First, the guy with 5 comes and says, "Master, you gave me 5 talents. I have made 5 more. Behold," and he gives him 10 talents. And the master says to him what every Christian hopes to hear on the final day: "Well done, my good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and enter into your master's blessedness." The next one comes and he said, "Master, you gave me 2 talents. Behold, I have made 2 more. And he gives him the 4 talents. And guess what? The master gives him exactly the same blessing. "Well done, my good and faithful servant." Well, that doesn't seem fair. The first guy made 5. The second guy only made 2. But you know what? Both of those servants made full use of their gifts, right? Some of us get 5, some of us get 2, some of us get 1, some of us get none. We call those people Aggies in Texas. Oh, you understand the joke. Very good. Okay. But we all have some gift that God has given us, and God expects us to make full use of that gift. But he's not unfair. He doesn't expect someone with two gifts to produce as much as one with five. So they get the same blessing because they have made use of the gifts God gave us. We didn't just waste them away. But then how does the story end? The third one comes and his knees are shaking. And he said, Master, well, I heard things about you. I heard you were a harsh taskmaster, that you reap where you did not sow and gather where you did not scatter seed. And so I was afraid and I buried your talent. Here is your talent back. And the master says, you wicked and lazy servant. You knew that I was a harsh taskmaster, that I sow where I do not reap where I do not sow and gather where I did not scatter seed. You should at least have put my talent in the bank so it would have gotten interest. And then he took the guy and he cast him out into a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. He sent him to Detroit, actually. What happened? So, again, we need to make use. You got to keep up because we're moving fast here today. You need, you know, when I was a kid, I'm 53 now. When I was a kid, we would have made jokes about Pittsburgh, but somehow they fixed this city up beautifully. I mean, anybody that's, if you're at least 40 years old, you remember that Pittsburgh was like a city where you couldn't breathe. Literally, right? But anyway, they fixed it up. So anything's possible. Maybe Detroit, maybe not. But anyway, they're trying. So everybody in hell in one way or another has wasted away their gifts. It is a place of sorrow and waste. And again, there are sins of commission, right? We do sin, but there are sins of omission. We need to make use of the light that God has given us. Now, that does not mean we have to make money out of our gift. That might mean that, okay? But, you know, again, it depends how we're going to use it. But we need to use it to serve God and serve God's people. And if we don't, we're wasted away and we end up in hell, a place of waste, a place of wasted potential and gifts that have not been used. By the way, we don't have too many young people here, but one thing to remember, I hear so many students praying and praying for a gift and God doesn't give it to them. And I say, have you used the gift that God gave you yet? Right? God's given you, use it. Maybe if you use that well, God will give you another one. But don't ask God to give you a gift when you've made no use of the ones he's given to you. So what I love about the Inferno is even if you're teaching in a secular school, there is a message there for students. And it is use your gifts, if they're Christians, to glorify God and serve your fellow man. All right. Once they get through, they come to the first circle of hell. There are nine circles. The first circle of hell is limbo. And that's where Dante puts the virtuous pagans, most of the people that we teach in our schools. They're there, right? Now, what's interesting is this is the only place in hell where there isn't specifically a punishment. The virtuous pagans are walking back and forth on the grass, talking to each other, but their punishment is that they lack hope. When Dante first arrives there, he hears a sound like this. Ah, just a sort of sigh. These are people that are not being actively punished, but they lack hope to move on to heaven. Now, that used to bother me a little bit when I read that. Oh, what about poor Virgil and things like that? Until I read carefully the description of limbo. The description of limbo is identical to the description of what the Greeks and Romans called the Elysian fields or the blessed groves. In a sense, Dante has given them what they desired, but only up to the limit of their desire. Right? We need to desire. We need to have imagination. That doesn't mean it's sinful not to have an imagination, but we need to imagine, right, the glory and the beauty and the wonder of God, and we need to desire after that. They are stymied because that was a blot. The most they could understand was walking back and forth and talking. And, you know, some of us, you know, tonight I'm sure I'll join a group out there smoking their pipes and stuff like that. I mean, that's about as good as it gets on earth, okay? But there's more than that, okay? There is more. You know, the Inklings is wonderful. But we need to imagine the greater glory that God has, more meaning, more purpose, love, participating in the life of the Trinity. So, again, I think that there is a fairness there that they've been given what they can imagine. When we move to the second level, we start to get our active punishments. Now, the way hell works is as you go down deeper, it gets worse and worse. It gets darker. It gets colder. It gets smellier. It gets heavier. And the sins get worse and the punishments get worse. So the first level, the second level we're going to come to, is going to be the least bad sin. It's a sin they're being punished, but it's the least bad sin. And what does Dante choose for the least bad sin? Lust. Now, if you're, you know, good evangelical like me, it's like, well, I thought that was the worst one. What's going on here? Wait a minute. Why is lust the least bad sin? Lust is the least bad sin because at least there's an element of love. There's a misdirection of desire, but at least there is an element of love. And in fact, the early, the first five levels of hell, what are called upper hell, they punish what are called sins of incontinence. That means sins of excess. They don't really hurt other people. They hurt you, generally speaking. And they usually take something good. Love, sexuality is good too, but take it to an excess in the wrong way with the wrong person at the wrong time. And you get the sin of lust. So, again, I'll say this many times, okay? Most of you, I think probably Protestant like myself, how many of you grew up having this mantra beaten into you? All sin is sin. You heard that? Okay? I heard that. And I started thinking about that. I said, that's not really true. Now, I don't know because I can't figure out where it started, but I think it probably started because Protestants like myself were like, we're not Catholics. We don't have mortal and venial sins. Okay? Now, yes, all sin is sin. All sin cuts us off from God's glory. But there are worse sins than the other. The worst sins are the ones that cut us off from God more. The less bad sins are the ones that there's still hope. There's still sins. Even one sin keeps us away from God. But we need to understand that the sins of the soul are worse than the sins of the flesh. This was understood for a long, long time, and I'll talk about it a little bit more tomorrow because C.S. Lewis is very good in this as well. But understand, it's not that the sin is, I don't know, ontologically worse. It's that there are certain sins that barricade us more effectively against the love and grace and mercy of God. So that's what we mean. It's getting worse and worse. It's getting colder. The first time you read the Inferno and you find that the center of the Inferno is made of ice, didn't that blow your mind? Because the worst sin of all is treachery. The traitors are the worst sinners of all. There's not a speck of love left in them, and they are in an ice cap. Okay, we'll get there in a second. So one more thing about level two. One of the people they meet in, and by the way, the lustful are being blown around. They're naked and they're being blown around and around by the wind. Just like they were controlled by their lusts on earth, they're controlled by the wind, being blown. They meet Paolo and Francesca, the lovers that are adulterous lovers in an eternal embrace. That sounds wonderful, but it's not. Okay, around it. And one of the people they meet in level two is someone from the Aeneid. Does anybody know who it is? It is Dido. Now, shouldn't Dido be deeper down? What did Dido do? Killed herself, right? But Dante says she killed herself for love. See, it's not like we're guilty of one sin and nothing else, right? But in Dante's world, every one of us has a defining sin. That sin that really kept Dido away from grace was not the sin of suicide. It was the sin of lust taken to the extreme. So what is it that is keeping us from God, that is keeping us from confessing and asking forgiveness and embracing that grace? That's the sin that keeps us away. And Dante understands that theologically, but he also understands it psychologically. All right, level two is lust. We move to level three, and that's gluttony. Okay, the Baptist potluck. I mean, we indulge in gluttony, okay? That's not one of the seven deadly sins. And then afterwards, we go home and sit in front of our TV. That's called sloth. We've just kind of slipped them away, okay? Now, the gluttons are bouncing up and down in a sort of filthy kind of stew, and Cerberus, the three-headed dog of hell, is ripping at them. Now, one of the misunderstandings of people that read the Inferno, they read the Inferno and they think, oh my gosh, Dante is like an adolescent boy. He must have been sitting up and down and wondering cool ways to kill people, like Friday the 13th or Saw or something like that. And we want to read it and we want to reduce it to a simple poetic justice, punishment to fit the crime. Okay, first of all, it is punishment to fit the crime. That is justice. But it's much, much deeper, more spiritual and more psychological than that. It's not just punishment to fit the crime. The sin creates its own punishment. In the punishment, we are seeing the sin taken to its extreme, right? We find out that the people that go into hell cross over eagerly, because hell promises them that they can have themselves and their sin forever. That's what they want. They want their sin and they want themselves. And so in the nature of the punishment, we see the nature of the sin and how it's a misdirection of what God would have us do. So again, it's much deeper as we go deeper and we look into this. We need to understand that sin brings its own consequences. In a way, it creates its own anti-world. And you're stuck in that world and you can't get out of it. The next level are for the hoarders and wasters. And the one after that are for the wrathful and sullen. Now, why is it that these sins that seem so different, wrath and sloth, or hoarding, being a miser like Scrooge, or being a spendthrift, a prodigal, a waster, they seem very different. What are they doing in the same circle? Well, what did Aristotle tell us virtue is? Virtue is the mean between the extremes. Ultimately, prodigality and miserliness are the same sin because they're both a wrongful excess of how we use money, right? One sort of worship money and hoards it. The other doesn't respect it and just spends it. In the middle is virtue, right? And this is so important, and I know you teach this to your students. So many people think that the golden mean is, I'll try anything once. That's not virtue. That's stupidity. Wait, you're going to try arsenic once? Okay, that is not what, but a lot of people think that's what it means. It kind of gets tied to that YOLO thing. You only live once. Let's try it once. It won't hurt me. No. Virtue is finding the proper. Courage is the middle point between cowardice on one side and foolish, cocky bravado on the other. We need to, so, you know, now, of course, most of you know that the Inferno is based very much on the teachings of Thomas Aquinas, which itself is based very much on Aristotle. So Aristotle is there all the time. And Virgil is almost like a classical Christian person, because when Dante asks him a question, he says, haven't you read your Aristotle? You really need to ask me that question? And in fact, he just calls Aristotle the philosopher. He's just like Virgil is the poet. Right? It's all there. By the way, if you read Mere Christianity, book 3 of Mere Christianity is all about living the Christian life. And most of what Lewis says about morality comes right out of Aristotle. Because Aristotle was right about that. He wasn't right about Christ because he didn't know about that. But when he wrote about morality, he was generally right. And Aquinas, of course, saw that. So let's look at the hoarders and wasters. They are pushing boulders back and forth endlessly. One is saying, why do you hoard? The other is saying, why do you waste? And they're going on and on in this sick game forever. Dante can't even recognize any of their faces because they're so absorbed in their sick game. Now, I said one of Dante's wonderful insights is that the damned are actually excited to go to hell. This is how it's explained. When they come down here, it says they all cross over eagerly, for here divine justice so transforms them that their dread becomes wish, they yearn for what they fear. A lot of the sinners in hell are involved in a sort of sick game that goes on forever and forever, but they don't want to break away from it. They're actually part of this game, and it consumes them. How can we yearn for what we fear? Isn't that psychologically impossible? How can we desire the very thing that hurts us? And yet, any kind of addictive behavior is like that, right? Let's say you might meet a girl that just keeps having one bad relationship after another. Why does she keep doing this? Doesn't she see, right? Somebody getting caught, some guy getting caught up in drugs or something. We are actually seeking after the very thing that hurts us. We actually see this happening on the earth. In hell, it's just, to a certain extent, perfected. Because Aristotle said, you know, both good and evil are perfected in the end. That's what Revelation says. As we get closer to the end, good will become more good, evil will become more evil. They will separate and reach their own perfection. Of course, there's no such thing as a perfection of evil, but as perfect as evil can get, as we're separated. So watch out. Again, some people, in some ways, want to be in hell because it promises them that they will have that sin forever. And basically, the sin, as I said, defines their life and their existence from now on. The sin has become themselves. And in fact, some of you know that when Dante, level 5, the wrathful and sullen, they're crossing the river Styx, which is really a marsh, a swamp. And as they're crossing it, a sinner named Filippo Argente grabs a hold of Dante and wants some help. And Dante says, I want to see that guy scrubbed down. And immediately Virgil embraces Dante and said, blessed is the woman who gave you birth. Now, why is he blessing Dante for being mean to this sinner? Doesn't the Bible tell us to love the sinner but hate the sin? The trouble is, by the time we get to hell, there is no sinner left. The sinner has become his sin. And that's why, because again, how can God damn someone, right? Aren't we supposed to love the sinner? There is no sinner left. There is just the sin going on, playing out the sick game over and over again. I remember many years ago, some of you might remember this, there was a great commercial against drug use. And it was this man all dressed up, real handsome and stuff, businessman. And he's in a circular room, a white room. And the man is looking at us and he says, I do drugs so that I can work harder, so that I can make more money, so that I can buy more drugs, so that I can work. And as he says it, he goes circle and more until he's running around like a rat in a cage or a gerbil, on and on and on and on. About half of the punishments in hell, the sinners are going in a circle. Now in heaven, the circle represents perfection. In hell, the circle represents futility. On and on and not getting anywhere. The sin doesn't take you anywhere. You don't learn. You don't grow. It's like being caught in a Freudian repetition compulsion, obsessive compulsive disorder. On and on. The same thing. Oh, as if you washed your hands so much your skin fell off. But you keep doing it. On and on. They can't break out of that cycle because the sinner has become his sin. Again, deep psychological understanding of the nature of evil and what it does to us and what it does to our humanity. Once they cross the river Styx, they come to what's called the city of Dis. And it's the transition between upper hell and lower hell. And the city of Dis is all closed up, and then the devils are protecting it. But Dante has divine help, and so he goes in to the city of Dis and moves forward to level 6. Level 6 punishes the sin of heresy. And Dante seemed to have in mind a lot of heretics in his day who denied the immortality of the soul, who were materialists and thought when we die, and that's it. And Dante has a very scary punishment for them. The souls of all the heretics are crammed into coffins, and the coffins are on fire. And every coffin has thousands of souls crushed into it, and it's burning them. So the meaning seems to be they thought that their soul would die with their body, and so it does. And it's really kind of scary, because remember, there's a perfection at the end. When the second coming comes and they get their resurrection bodies, an angel will come and nail the lids on the coffin. It's one of the scariest details. Now, one of the heretics that Dante meets is a man named Farinata. And he was an aristocrat. And when Dante arrives, Farinata rises up out of the burning tomb from his waist up, and he's got his chest out looking noble, and Dante's a little bit intimidated and talks to him and whatnot. But what's fascinating about this is that Farinata looks very noble, but he's naked and he's in a burning coffin. In hell, we can no longer fool anybody except ourselves. When you're reading the Divine Comedy, you might wonder, how is it that Dante recognizes people? We don't have our resurrection bodies till the end. How is it that he recognizes? Well, we don't find the answer till we read Purgatory. But Dante comes up with this neat idea that when we die, our body goes through the ether. That's the fifth element, quintessence. The fifth element, it goes through the ether, and the ether forms an airy body around us. But here's the difference. This body doesn't necessarily reflect the soul. But that airy body takes its look from the soul. The soul gives it the paradigm, and the airy body follows it. And so now the body looks like the soul. Let me try to explain this a little better. If I brought two girls that were like 22 years old, and I brought them forward, and I told them just to have a neutral expression, two pretty young girls, have a neutral expression on their face. And I said to you, one of these girls is sweet and kind and helpful and loving. The other one is grasping and mean and vain and hurts people. Could you necessarily tell which is which by looking at them? At the age of 20, not necessarily. But let's say I bring two 80-year-old grandpas up here, right? And I say one of them was the pawpaw everybody wants in Texas, sweet, helpful, helping his grandkids. The other one, again, is mean, exploited his workers. Can you tell which is which now? You can. George Orwell once said that by the age of 50, everyone gets the face he deserves. Now, I'm 53, so I don't know how I'm doing there, okay? But watch out. Those of you that are in your 20s or 30s, it is true. Sooner or later, we are going to look like our soul. And you do understand, you all know about the picture of Dorian Gray, okay? The picture of Dorian Gray doesn't just age while Dorian Gray stays young. It's much more spiritual than that. Not only does he sells his soul, right, so that the picture will take his age, but what it does is not only does the picture age for him, it bears the mark of his depravity. So Dorian Gray, despite all of the sins he does, not only continues to look young, he continues to look innocent because the picture is bearing the marks of what depravity does to us eventually. So watch out. We will eventually become our sin. We will become our soul. In heaven, you cannot fool anyone anymore except yourself. Dante gives a lot of dignity to Farinata and a few other people that he meets, Ser Brunetto and a few others, even Francesca. But look at them. There is no nobility left. They can only fool themselves. So watch out what sin does to us. Once we leave 6, Dante and Virgil stop because the bottom 3 levels of hell stink so terribly they have to wait and let their nose get adjusted. But nobody wants to waste time. We don't want to end up with, you know, the opportunists or the slothful people. And so they discuss the general architecture of hell. And we discover that 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are all sins of incontinence. And they are considered less bad sins, as Aristotle believed and also as Aquinas believed. They're less bad because, again, they have an element of love. And because, generally speaking, they only hurt you and they don't hurt other people, right? So, again, sexuality is a good thing. Taken to an excess, it becomes lust. It's good to eat, but too much, you become a glutton. It's good to save money, and it's good to spend money. But if you go to an extreme, it's good to have righteous anger. It's also good to relax and have leisure, but take it to an extreme, you get that. Level 7, 8, 9, which punish what he calls malice, they are much worse. Those are sins of the soul that hurt other people. There's less and less of a glimpse of goodness in the sins of malice. And the sins of malice are violence and deceit or fraud. Now, Dante never tells us where heresy belongs, but most scholars would agree that heresy is a transition, because heresy in one way is an excess of wisdom taken to the wrong extent, to be a Gnostic or something, but it's also a violence against church doctrine. So it's somewhere in between. Now, why is fraud worse than violence? To a certain extent, an animal can be violent. The nature of violence is bestiality. We become like a beast. And in fact, level 7 is guarded by the Minotaur, half man and half bull. But deceit, only a human being can be deceitful. Well, one exception, all cats are deceitful. Okay. But other than that, nobody's saying no. Okay. My daughter would say no if she was here. I want you to think about it. The only way you can deceive somebody is because we have consciousness, because we have conscience, because God has given us reason, we are able to present a friendly face while we've got a knife behind our back. So fraud is the worst of all because we're taking God's greatest gift, human reason and conscience, and we're twisting it. Right? Again, sins of the soul rather than sins of the flesh. Violence is subdivided because we can be violent against others, that is a murderer. We can be violent against ourselves, that's suicide. Or we can be violent against God, which is blasphemy. And all of these people are punished in fire, not just because fire burns, but because fiery burning things are ultimately sterile. And when we are violent, we are creating a sterile world. Now, the first, the violent against other people, those are the murderers, the mass murderers, if you will. they are in the third river, Phlegeton, which is a river of boiling blood, which is what Phlegeton means. It means fiery in Greek. So they're in a river of boiling blood, and they are, depending on the severity of their violence, they could be up to here, they could be up to their chest, they could be up to their eyebrows. I hate to tell you, but Alexander the Great is up to his eyebrows in burning blood. Julius Caesar, he's a virtuous pagan, okay? So I got to defend Alexander. But anyway, just to give you an example, if you walked into a room of like lawyers or politicians and shot everybody, you'd be like, you know, up to here in boiling blood. If you killed a teacher, right up to here, okay? Right up to your eyebrows in boiling blood. But even there, there's always a kind of justice, a ranking between the two. Probably the most famous of all is level 7B, the suicides. Because when Dante goes there, he doesn't see any sinners. He just sees these weird, twisty trees, kind of like out of Wizard of Oz, scary-looking trees. And what's going on? And Virgil says, break off a branch. And he breaks off a branch, and all of a sudden, he hears this sound, p-p-p-p-p, and sap and blood come out, and it begins to speak. What happens is, when you're a sinner, when you're a suicide, you come before King Minos, and he judges you. And if you're a suicide, you're cast all the way down to level 7. And what happens is you go, whoosh, and you just fall randomly anywhere in that level. And immediately, your soul starts to spring up into a beautiful tree. But then it gets distorted and corrupt and perverse. Just like a suicide begins with such hopefulness, but giving way to grief and despair causes it to, you know, get twisted. And look at this. The only way the suicides can speak is by the shedding of their blood. Their ultimate act of self-expression was the shedding of their own blood, and now that's the only time they can speak. Again, we're trying to see the nature of the sin in the nature of the punishment. Now we move down, and Dante likes to have fun with us. It's actually 7A, 7B, 7C, 1, 2, 3. Because you can sin again, you can be violent against God, or you can be violent against the child of God. The child of God is nature. Or you can be violent against the grandson of God. And all of this goes back to Aristotle and Aquinas. You've got God, nature, and then you've got what the Greeks call techne, which means an art or a skill. Those who are violent against God are the blasphemers. Those who are violent against nature are the sodomites. This is the politically incorrect part. This is where the homosexuals are. And by the way, we only meet men there. I don't know if Dante never heard of lesbians, whatever, but we only see men there. So sodomy is violence against nature, and then violence against art. Does anybody know what that's called? Do you know? It's called usury. Do you know that one of the worst sins in the Middle Ages is the very foundation of our capitalist system? Usury is giving money for lending money on interest. Some say lending money. Some say lending money at extreme versions of interest. But in the Catholic Middle Ages, you were not allowed to practice usury. Do you know that? By the way, there's a religion today that still doesn't practice usury. You know what that is? Islam also forbids usury. They've got a very strange system in Saudi Arabia where if I go to borrow $100, they just give me 70. So they're getting around usury because you can't have banking without that. So they're getting around it. That's why, so who were the only people allowed to be bankers in the Middle Ages? Who's left? Were the Jews. And I really think that's the real origin of anti-Semitism. And they didn't like usury because they saw usury as making money without working. And you know what? A lot of us think that the punishment on Adam was work. The punishment on Adam was not work. Adam was meant to work in the garden. The punishment is he would now work by the sweat of his brow and nature would fight him, right? This is the way I put it. Adam might have had a lawnmower in Eden. He did not have an edger, okay? I live in Houston where grass is perverse and grows sideways. We call it St. Augustine grass. It's not really grass. It's a weed that we've decided we like it. But it's really a weed, and it goes sideways. It doesn't happen up north, okay? We don't have real grass like you have up here. It grows sideways. But we were men. The same thing. There seems like there would have been some pain in childbirth, but God said, I will greatly increase that. Right? So it's not work. It's work of a futile kind. That is the point. We were meant to work. Now, does anybody read Touchstone here? You've got to read Touchstone. It's great. Okay. I just published an article with them about the whole gay rights movement and gay marriage and something that I'm kind of learning from Dante. Okay. A lot of people will say, and they're right, that that homosexuality, inasmuch as it's a sin of the flesh, is less bad than pride and other things. And that is true. But what's happened in our day and age, this happened even 20 years. It's one thing to have a man struggling with his sexuality, giving into it, asking forgiveness, confessing. Maybe if you're Catholic, you go to confession, and fighting with it. That's very different than saying, screw you, God, this is who I am. Do you see what's happened? That's what scares me about it. It's always been around. Sin, all sins have always been around. But now when we start identifying ourselves by it and putting our fist up against God, what's happening is it's going from becoming a sin of the flesh to becoming a sin of the soul, right? It's becoming, as it says somewhere in Isaiah, I think, the sinner is the one who says, I am, and there is no other beside me. We are starting to say, I define myself, and you have no say in that. That's the danger, okay, as we move down. Okay, we move down. I've got to keep an eye on mine. I just got a smartphone 1 week. I've always had a flip phone. I've given in, really. It's kind of terrible. Okay, is it good? It's good. Okay, I can actually check my email now. It's amazing. My daughter's taught me how to use emojis now, so I've got to send her cute little faces every time I send her a text. But got to be a good father. By the way, my daughter's 20. She's not. It's 21, almost 21. She's not a little kid, but she loves her emojis. But anyway, they all love that stuff, right? Quickly, let me just tell you a little bit about level 8 punishes simple fraud. Level 9 is complex fraud, and that's treachery, right? Because being a thief or being an evil counselor or being a Pharisee, that's really bad. But what's worse is when you betray somebody you should love, your family, your country, your master, whatever. So that's the difference between level 8 and 9. But level 8 has 10 sub-levels. I'll just focus on a few of them. One of my favorite punishments is 8B, okay? It punishes the flatterers. And the flatterers are bouncing up and down in a room full of human excrement, right? On earth, they were slinging it, and now they're bobbing up and down in it. Very important. By the way, just in case some of you wonder why it's called the Divine Comedy, it's called a comedy for two reasons. One, it does have a happy ending, but it's a comedy because it has a mixture of styles. You do not get bathroom jokes in Virgil, okay? No way, or Cicero. But Dante wanted a mixture of styles. When he's talking about hell, he uses four-letter words and all sorts of potty jokes and things like that. He doesn't do that when he gets to paradise, right? It's a mix. That's what comedy means, a mixture of styles. Okay, hell is the sewer of the universe, right? Eventually, every kind of sin, every kind of darkness will find its way down to hell. Level 3 is a sin we don't hear about much. It's called simony, named after Simon, the guy who wanted to buy the Holy Spirit. Remember that guy? He's the arch-heretic. Eusebius calls him the arch-heretic, the first great heretic. The simonists are people who buy and sell church office. That was bigger. Well, I don't know. Somebody might want to buy their way into a megachurch. Those guys make a lot of money. But generally speaking, we don't make enough money to do simony these days. But that was a really big sin back then. And they're, what's that? That's good. That's true. Yeah, it's kind of cozy. It's not too bad. It's good, But hey, if you're a pastor, you don't get your summers off. And you know what? I worked really hard on this speech, but if I go speak next month, I could give this speech again. If you're a pastor, you better not give the same sermon. I'm serious. Some elder will say, hey, that's a good sermon. I remember that from 5 years ago. Think about it. You have to come up with an absolute. And if you're a Reformed pastor, every single sermon has to be tied to the Bible. You can't take them on a journey through Dante's Inferno. I can come up with 100 sermons from Dante. No, there better be a Bible text there. So it's not easy. It'd be nice to your pastors. It's not easy to come up with something every single time. Anyway, so quickly, the simony, these people are literally baptized into living rock. They're head first in the rock, and their feet have burning oil. What it is it is a perversion of baptism and holy unction, two of the sacraments. Now, you need to understand that everything in hell is a perversion of something on the earth or something in heaven. You need to understand, Augustine was absolutely right when he said sin is a privation. Sin and Satan cannot create anything. All that the devils can do is take something God made and pervert it into something else. So everything, like I said, in heaven, the circle represents God, eternity. In hell, the circle represents futility. When he sees Satan has three heads because he's a perversion of the Trinity. So we need to understand. Okay. How many of you, nobody told you this, but how many of you grew up thinking that virtue is the absence of vice? In other words, the way to be virtuous is sit around and not drink or smoke or chew or deal with people who do. That's Southern Baptist, right? It's completely the opposite. Vice is the perversion of virtue. Virtue is an active, living thing. But we have gotten this desiccated vision of virtue, which just means sitting around and doing nothing. Virtue moves forward and changes the world. Right? Again, hell is not... I hate this. You only win an Academy Award by playing some evil person like Silence of the Lambs. What about getting an Academy Award for playing a person of goodness? It's harder to play somebody good than play somebody bad. It's easy to play somebody bad. Right? It's a stereotype. C.S. Lewis said, how monotonously the same are all the tyrants. They're all the same, whether it's Hitler or Stalin or Pol Pot or Castro or any of these people. They're all the same, or Saddam Hussein. But how wonderfully different are all the saints, okay? Virtue moves out and grows, okay? So we need to understand that sin does not create anything. Goodness, in Screwtape Letters, the devil says, all of our work, we've never been able to create one pleasure. All they can do is take pleasures God made and get us to use them in the wrong way with the wrong person at the wrong time. Okay, maybe all at once. I do remember I went to a drive-in theater once, drive-in movie to see the Ten Commandments. There was a couple in the next car breaking seven of them. It's amazing. Yeah, okay, I guess it's slow. I think I'm out of time. I got a few more minutes. Okay. Are you excited about this Gray Havens tonight? Like ready to go to the Gray Havens. We're all going to take the boat and go with the elves. Are you ready? I'm going to go see the elves, Mr. Frodo. But anyway, let me just say a few last comments. So, Simony, we go down to the fortune tellers. We go down to graft. Again, these endless sick games. Let me end with what I think is actually the most creative of all Dante's punishments, even more so than the suicide. Remember, I'll end with this. And, oh, by the way, let me not forget. Now I'm a real ACCS guy because I've published books with Canon Press, okay? These just came out. They're worldview guides to the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid. And they've got them at Canon Press, and I've got a lot of books at 8th Day. So right after this, I'll go over to 8th Day if you want me to sign. I've got to go to dinner at 5:30, but I'll be back and forth. And if you've got something here, I'll sign it too. But let me end with the most amazing punishment. Okay, the hypocrites, their punishment is they're walking in a circle forever and they're wearing these robes that look beautiful and white on the outside, but they're made of lead and they're dragging them down forever. Okay, that's good enough. But on that level are special punishments for Caiaphas and all of the Pharisees and Sadducees who took part in the crucifixion of Jesus. Caiaphas, the one who said it is good for one person to die for the people, he is literally crucified on spikes on the floor. Crucified on spikes. And as each of the hypocrites walks in their circle, they step on him and drive him onto the nails. Little boys love reading Dante's Inferno. Now, I tell you that because it's really gross, but there's something more going on here. Do you see what's happening? Do you see that Caiaphas is becoming a perversion of Christ? In the same way that Christ bore the sins of all of us on the cross, Caiaphas is bearing the weight, the literal weight, of all the hypocrisy in the universe. Every single hypocrite who has ever lived, who has not found grace, every single hypocrite at one time or another will step on Caiaphas and drive him on the nails. But here's the big difference. As you know, Christ died once and for all our sins. Our sacrifice, however you guys practice the Lord's Supper, it is a bloodless sacrifice, okay? But guess what? After every single hypocrite in the universe steps on Caiaphas, you know what happens? Starts all over again because it's the endless circle of futility going on and on without end, without growth, without knowledge, without insight, right? So hell is a place where you either don't use your gifts, or you use them and you pervert them. I don't have time to go into that. Let me close in prayer. And like I said, I'll hang out here and I'll go over to 8th Day Books. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about what C.S. Lewis learned from Dante in The Great Divorce. And we're going to talk more about the nature of sin. And we're going to talk about how sin dehumanized. But let me just close quickly in prayer. Father God, we thank you for the legacy of Dante and for writing this book that has moved people for 700 years. Lord, help us to move out of that darkness, out of that self-centered narcissism. Help us to let you make us a new Father, lest we be caught in our own individual hell in an endless repetition compulsion. We thank you for your grace. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Thank you all. I hope I'll see some of you tomorrow. Thank you all.